The topic of my presentation is the Missouri Synod into all the world. In studying the history of the mission expansion of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod into all the world, it is good to keep in focus the fact that the Christian Church has had almost 2,000 years of mission expansion, whereas the Missouri Synod itself is only a little over 130 years old. The Missouri Synod was founded in 1847, only a little over 130 years ago, and therefore when we speak of the Missouri Synod into all the world, we must keep in mind that there was much world mission expansion on the part of the many other Christian churches well before the Missouri Synod ever came into existence. When the Missouri Synod was organized in Chicago in 1847, there was an enormous mission challenge right at the doorsteps of this new church body. For this was the period of expansion in the new states in the Midwest of our great country, with tens of thousands of new immigrants making new land claims, building new homes, erecting new towns. Reaching out to these people was called the work of inner missions, or home missions, as we would prefer to call it today. It was called inner missions because formerly the immigrants to be reached had been or were Christians. In other words, it was not an outreach to the unchurched people or to the heathen peoples of the world. It was the genius of the Missouri Synod that the pastors knew how to reach out to these immigrants and organize congregations and establish schools. In a way, this was easier mission work than working among unchurched in far-off countries in strange cultures by means of a very difficult language. We need not be surprised, therefore, to see in this inner mission outreach, in the early decades of the Missouri Synod, there were fantastic statistics in church growth. Another aspect of Missouri Synod missions was the outreach to the American Indian. The first outreaches by Protestants to Indians in America, begun 200 years before the Missouri Synod was organized, had a rather uneven record. There were some success stories in the various outreaches to the American Indians over those two centuries, but by and large, white Americans did not understand the American Indians, and they did not know how to make a successful Christian witness to them without destroying their cultural structures. By the time the Missouri Synod came into existence, Indian mission projects had been failing in great numbers. Indian tribes by that time had been pushed around so often by white people, and their lands and other possessions had been confiscated, so that Indians by and large did not trust the white man even when he came in peace and as missionaries and church workers. One of the confusing issues in the white Christian outreach to the American Indian was the confusion between civilizing the Indians and Christianizing them. And then it also needs saying that there were many white Americans who took advantage of the Indians as traders and as land agents and in other capacities, so that there were actually many more people who had been taking advantage of the Indians and cheating and deceiving them than that came to do them good and to help them. There were Lutherans in America who had reached out to Indians well before the Missouri Synod was organized. But in the 1840s, William Leahy, the Bavarian churchman, who did so much to send church workers to America, many of whom helped found the Missouri Synod, became interested in the need of the American Indians, too. Leahy, therefore, sent some missionaries specifically to work among the Indians. These first Leahy missionaries to American Indians went to Michigan, and William Hutstett is especially remembered as the pioneer of this Lutheran Indian mission venture. He came first to assess the needs and to explore the field, and soon the Reverend August Kramer was sent by Leahy with a small colony of lay people to establish a Lutheran settlement in Frankenmuth, Michigan, in the Saginaw Valley. This settlement was to serve as a base from which Kramer, the pastor of the settlers, was to reach out in mission outreach to the Indians. The Chippewa tribe, among whom Kramer tried to work, was already very demoralized from constant exploitation on the part of the white people. In fact, by the time the Leahy missionaries tried to reach them in Michigan, most of the Chippewa Indians, or Ojibways, as they called themselves in their own language, had already migrated to the area as far west as Lake Superior. The Lutheran missions starting to work among the Indians in the Saginaw Valley then were working only among those Indian clans that had been left behind in this enormous demographic movement that took most of the tribe much farther westward. Kramer thought that an effective way of reaching the Indians was to establish a school for the Indian children. He therefore set up such a school in Frankenmuth in connection with his own church, which provided the spiritual needs for the white settlers, and then he invited the Indians to send their children into the white settlement to attend school there, even though their tribal homes were some distance away in the forest. Although they gained some converts this way, this system of working from an established mission station proved generally ineffective. And one of the main reasons was that at certain seasons of the year, the Indian parents would take their children out of school to help with either hunting or with fishing, or when the sap on the sugar maples ran, the Indian children had to help with gathering that to make sugar, and therefore attendance at the school proved to be very irregular. Also because Kramer, as well as most other missionaries at that time, trying to work among Indians via the English language and sometimes by means of interpreters, the Indian children often forgot most of what they had learned in a few weeks in attendance by the time they came back from some of these enforced absences from school. Before very long, Kramer got some other help to assist in the outreach to the Indians. Because his own white congregation was growing, and there were small Indian villages scattered in the forests of Michigan, which took weeks of travel to reach under those primitive conditions. Some of those missionaries who came out in the middle of the 1840s then soon joined the Missouri Synod when it was organized in 1847. And therefore, this mission enterprise among the Indians in Michigan became Missouri Synod mission work. Edmund R. Beierlein is one of those who came out soon after August Kramer himself came. And Beierlein came to America in 1847, although he was only on loan from the Leipzig Mission Society, a German society that was at that time emphasizing especially training and sending missionaries to India. And then Beierlein was soon recalled by this mission society in 1853 to be sent to India, his original mission field objective. But Beierlein worked in central Michigan among the Chippewa Indians as soon as he came in 1847. Feuerlein had a most effective approach because he used the inductive method of reaching out to the Indians. In fact, when he came, he was somewhat critical of Kramer's approach because Kramer worked from a fixed mission station in Frankenmuth. And Feuerlein asked the disturbing question, if one wants to work among the Indians, why not go and live in an Indian village? Feuerlein also was concerned that it was of primary importance to learn the Indian language rather than trying to work through interpreters. At any rate, when Feuerlein had asked these probing questions, Kramer obviously had become somewhat irritated, and this may be one of the reasons that he suggested that Feuerlein might well consider going to an Indian village that was at a considerable distance from Frankenmuth, almost due west, in Gratiot County, almost the very center of Lower Michigan. First of all, Feuerlein determined that it was necessary for a missionary to work effectively, to learn the language of the people, and so he set this as his first major objective. He seems to have had a real gift for languages, and it does not seem to have taken him very long to be able to teach and preach in the Chippewa language. In fact, he became very proficient in that language and utilizing the system of alphabet that had been devised by earlier missionaries, he began to put together written materials that he could use as reading materials in his school that he soon organized for Indian children in their own village. Now, other missionaries had learned some of the Chippewa language, but their procedure was to preach in English and then have interpreters translate this into the Chippewa language. Furthermore, Feuerlein decided that it was necessary to live among the Indians not just as a transient guest, but rather as an Indian himself. Another important factor in the outreach on the part of Feuerlein to the Chippewa Indians was the fact that he tried by inductive demonstration to show the Indians how to live a more sedentary life, which was becoming more and more necessary because the government was depriving the Indians of their ancestral lands. And this was a major factor in the sociological changes at that time, because the Indians were by force of necessity changing from a nomadic hunting lifestyle to a sedentary lifestyle, which would put more and more emphasis on farming. And Feuerlein's approach made it possible for Indians to continue in the semi-nomadic lifestyle, which had marked their whole lifestyle before, and settle down to farming and make this transition just at the time when almost all the land titles were being taken over by entrepreneurs and other settlers. So Feuerlein was therefore a model missionary, and the success which he experienced in the 6 years that he worked among the Chippewa Indians in Michigan also indicates this. Unfortunately, even before Feuerlein terminated his service among the Chippewa Indians, it was obvious that the government plans to relocate Indians on large reservations, which was also sponsored especially by the Methodist missionaries, had a very detrimental effect on the stability of Indian society and thus on their receptivity to the Christian message. And those Indians among whom Feuerlein had worked successfully, whom he had converted, and whom he had helped to secure specific land titles to small plots to enable them to do farming, were also greatly disturbed by this attractiveness to go to the large reservation. In other words, Indians in Michigan were being demoralized because they were being moved around too much by the social engineering and some of the churchmen, and also by government pressure. Therefore, the Missouri Synod Indian Mission Outreach in Michigan also suffered great setback. Some attempt was yet made to follow the Indians to the large reservation in Isabella County, Michigan, just north of where Byerline had been working, and also to reach the Chippewas in the state of Minnesota. However, the outbreak of the Civil War, as also a serious Indian uprising which took place in 1862, had further negative effects on the Missouri Synod's Indian mission outreach to the Chippewas, and the result was that in 1868, this whole enterprise was closed. During these decades, the Missouri Synod did not have its own overseas mission work, but they supported several Lutheran missionary societies based in Germany in their overseas mission enterprises. One was the Leipzig Missionary Society, and another one was called the Hermannsburg Missionary Society. The Missouri Synod supported societies like that, not only with cash donations for the support of their missionaries overseas, but also by sending greatest Missouri Synod literature, like periodicals and books published by the Synod, to any missionary who would request such aid. While the Missouri Synod was thus supporting some Lutheran mission enterprises abroad, it was also reaching out to quite a number of ethnic and linguistic minorities in this country. One of the more difficult challenges which the Missouri Synod faced was its mission to the Jews in America. Walter, the first president of the Missouri Synod and a very prominent theological and educational leader of our Synod, had always been much interested in this enterprise, and 4 years before he died in 1887, thus in 1883, he was able to see the beginning of this mission outreach to Jews in New York City. Another domestic mission outreach on the part of Lutherans, including the Missouri Synod, was the so-called Negro mission enterprise. Strictly speaking, this was not at first a Missouri Synod undertaking, because it was sponsored by a federation of Midwest confessional Lutheran synods, including the Missouri Synod. However, when this federation called the Synodical Conference was dissolved in recent decades, the Missouri Synod fell heir to most of this mission work among the blacks in America, and therefore this enterprise has more than just passing interest for our purposes right now. Ferdinand Sievers was the acknowledged leader of mission work in Missouri Synod circles in the middle decades of the 19th century. He had been one of those who kept pushing the mission enterprise among American Indians. However, when this work tapered off, Sievers began to challenge the leadership of Synod to undertake some other mission challenge. As was mentioned above, Synod did support the Leipzig Mission Society especially. One of the significant turning points, however, came in the 1870s when several missionaries of the Leipzig Mission Society working in India left that society for doctrinal reasons and then affiliated with the Missouri Synod. And thus it became more and more a matter of whether Synod should continue to help support the Missionary Society and its enterprise there in India as it had done in the past. Some of these men who had left that Leipzig Society brought back some disturbing reports, and they became pastors of our churches in America, and in fact, a few of them became prominent leaders in synods. There was, therefore, the beginning of an alienation between the Missouri Synod and the Leipzig Mission, and there was transferred also to the ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod here in America an increasing interest in India. Now, at first, Seaver's appeals found sympathetic response in the circles of the Synodical Conference, but its first interests were directed to the Negroes in the southern states. By 1877, the Synodical Conference elected a mission board to undertake and to manage this kind of new mission enterprise. Walther, who was very much interested in this enterprise himself, recommended a pastor who was serving as a traveling missionary in the Dakotas, John Deutscher. And upon this recommendation, the Synodical Conference Mission Board appointed Deutscher to serve as the first Synodical Conference missionary to the American Negroes. Deutscher began by traveling through areas of Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana to assess what other Christian churches had already done and what the particular nature of the challenges of mission work among the American blacks was at that time. He visited black pastors and congregations of other denominations to assess mission openings and opportunities. And before long, Deutscher unexpectedly received and accepted a call to St. John's congregation in New Orleans. Therefore, much of his ministry was spent in ministering to his white parishioners. He had some difficulty also with his membership in synod, especially in the election controversy, and when he suffered a nervous breakdown that terminated his ministry with synod there. Then Nils J. Bakke, a pastor in synod who was of Norwegian extraction, was then called to take over the Synodical Conference work in 1880, and he founded several new congregations in New Orleans, for black people especially, namely Mount Zion and also St. Paul's Lutheran Church there. And then another man was called there, namely Reverend August Borsdorf, who founded Bethlehem Congregation in 1887. In 1891, Bakke began his work in North Carolina, where the Alpha Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Freedmen in America had sought help from the Missouri Synod. And this is therefore a very interesting new development in mission work among blacks. Another man who was called to pick up some of the openings which Deutscher had discovered was Frederick Berg, who picked up the work in Little Rock, Arkansas. Thus, before long, the Synodical Conference had mission work among blacks in the South in several widespread areas. And before very long, the work also expanded into Alabama, where, in fact, an important focus for mission work to American blacks soon began to emerge. Several important new developments were the opening of a number of schools for the training of black Lutherans. Nils Bakke, in 1903, became the first teacher of Emmanuel Lutheran College in Greensboro, North Carolina. This school was later expanded into a seminary for the training of black pastors, and many of the graduates of our black ministry in various places in America graduate from this small but very good school. Many of the pastors in our ministry remember with great affection the sound training in Lutheran theology they received there. Now, unfortunately, that school has been closed. Another school founded under the supervision of this mission enterprise is the college in Selma, Alabama, which opened on November 13, 1922. Much more detail ought to be spelled out about the administration of this black mission work and the policy which was applied in the management of such enterprises. One of the difficulties which was encountered was the problem of membership of black pastors. Even in its well-intended, kindly outreach to the blacks in the southern states, the Lutheran Church found it a little bit difficult to receive the blacks on absolutely the same level as the white pastors, especially with a northern orientation, worked and found their proper relationships within the synodical organization. In the early decades of this mission history, black pastors had access to joining the English Synod of America, English Synod of Missouri. However, in 1911, this English Synod of Missouri dissolved and became the English District of Missouri, so there was no longer an autonomous English Synod which was affiliated theologically and doctrinally with the Missouri Synod. And there was a problem in the Missouri Synod as far as conceiving of the possibility that people of a different race and different language could become members of a German Lutheran Synod. The matter of synodical membership of the pastors and the integration of congregations composed of black members into either the synodical conference or into the Missouri Synod continued to be an unresolved problem for some years, till quite recent times. There was furthermore the problem of somewhat autocratic management of the affairs of the black missions and the black pastors who worked in those missions and congregations. And this was the second factor which no doubt retarded the growth of those missions to a considerable extent. One of the significant areas of expansion of the Missouri Synod was into South America just about the turn of the century. German Lutherans had been immigrating to certain countries in South America, especially Brazil and Argentina. Towards the end of the 19th century, a request from immigrants like that reached the Missouri Synod that they would reach out a helping hand and send pastors to organize congregations and to shepherd them. In 1899, therefore, Pastor Christian J. Broders from our synod surveyed the possibilities in Brazil and began some work there. Then in 1901, William Mahler, also a pastor of the Missouri Synod, became the first resident Missouri Synod pastor there. It was reported to the Missouri Synod that when work was begun in Rio Grande do Sul in 1899, there were about 30 large colonies of Germans in existence, many of the inhabitants of whom wanted very much to continue their church life as they had had it in their Lutheran churches in Germany. There was already a German synod organized among them, which was unfortunately patterned after the Union Church of Germany, and therefore not based on the confessional Lutheran theology as espoused by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. There were also many vagabond would-be clergymen who were fleecing these colonists, and therefore serious-minded Lutherans among them were most anxious to secure the services of well-trained, conscientious pastors. They had heard of the excellent ministry found in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in North America, and thus they had sent this inquiry and this call for help, and that turned out to be the beginning of our mission work in Brazil, out of which grew all the other mission work of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in Latin America. Our people reported that at first they met with much mistrust in Brazil, for people thought that they were North American political agents or some type of sectarian missionaries who came only to take advantage of the people. But when the German Lutheran immigrants learned the true intent of the Missouri Synod pastors, They began to look on them with real respect, and in a decade or a bit more, the Missouri Synod pastors had organized 11 congregations and several dozen preaching stations with over 12,000 souls and over 6,000 communicant members. It should be pointed out that this work also was considered inner missions, although it was in a foreign country, because it was being conducted among people who came from a generally Christian background and was not conducted among the unchurched. The state of Rio Grande do Sul thus became the center of our work in all of Latin America, and from this base mission work also reached out to Argentina within a few years to the south, as well as to other areas in Latin America. Work on the Isle of Pines off the coast of Cuba, for example, was begun in 1911 by a Lutheran pastor named C. Richard Ertel, who found Lutherans who had settled there and organized them into several congregations. In Cuba, work began 2 years after that, thus in 1913, when Pastor Ertel, at that time resident missionary on the Isle of Pines, preached to people in Havana. This outreach was at first intended to address itself to the German immigrants, but before long this work became more and more Spanish. Also in the Central American country of Guatemala and in the South American country of Venezuela, mission work on the part of the Missouri Synod was begun before long. The first overseas mission field which the Missouri Synod sponsored in Asia was our mission in India. Above, we mentioned that in the 1870s, several missionaries of the Leipzig Mission Society had left that society and joined the Missouri Synod Ministry in America. In the 1890s, there was a repetition of this when several missionaries began to be very much concerned with the theological deviations which they detected in the Leipzig Mission Society's stance. They objected to the position of their sending society and therefore got into difficulty, and thus they applied to the Missouri Synod for membership. Theodore Nather and Franz Lohn were the first two missionaries to take this step. On October 14, 1894, the Missouri Synod Board for Missions, meeting in St. Charles, Missouri, in conjunction with the Western District Convention, commissioned these two for work in India under the auspices of the Missouri Synod. These two men promptly returned to India under instruction not to work in competition with any other mission. They knew the Tamil language and surveyed some towns and villages west of Madras on the east coast of India, approximately 400 miles north of the southernmost tip of India. India is a vast land of many different languages and peoples and religions. Although it is only about one-third of the area of the United States, it has almost three times the population. It also has quite a number of religions, although Hinduism and Islam comprise two of the largest religious groups. There is a considerable diversity of languages, with over one dozen main languages in use in different areas and many scores of dialects and local languages. India was also a difficult culture in which to work because of the sharply defined caste system, which posed untold difficulties for missionaries of all churches. It was in the Tamil-speaking area of southeastern India, in the town of Krishnagiri, where Theodore Nather began his work in behalf of the Missouri Synod. In 1895, Pastor Kellerbauer, also a former Leipzig missionary, joined him there. Before long, the Missouri Synod was recruiting other German-born missionaries. Pastor A. Huebner went to India in 1900, and John Forster and George Naumann in 1902. The significant factor in almost each case of the earliest missionaries the Missouri Synod had sent is that they were German-born, albeit trained in the Missouri Synod seminaries in America. There is, in fact, a difficulty which the Missouri Synod Board for Missions experienced in recruiting American-born missionaries for work in India in the early decades of our work there, which is not exactly to the credit of our church body here in America. In the first decades of the history of our missions in India, these missionaries worked under enormous difficulty. India is a very difficult climate, with summer temperatures often going to 115 degrees day after day for long and weary months. Also, the problem of disease was by no means unsolved at the turn of the century. Missionary Nather had to see his two oldest children die of dysentery in 1900, just a few days apart. In the early years of the 20th century, there was furthermore an invasion of bubonic plague which swept through India, and many of the Christians in our mission stations died of this cause. And on February 13, 1904, missionary Nather himself died of the plague. There would be many other cases of hardships and heartbreaks which the missionaries had experienced working under most difficult and trying circumstances. The mission enterprise in India, however, experienced an amazing expansion in the southern triangle of India, with work beginning in Nagercoil in 1907. Missionary Huebner was sent there after an invitation had come in from the Sambabar caste, who felt neglected by the English mission working in that area. The request of the Missouri Synod mission came through a government official named G. Yesudasan, who soon became a leader in the Lutheran community there, and after some training was ordained as the first Missouri Synod pastor in all of India in 1921. Another area of southern India into which the Missouri Synod mission expanded was Trivandrum, a large city in southwestern India in Travancore. This was a new language area for the Missouri Synod mission outreach, since Malayalam is spoken in that area. Henry Now, who must be remembered as one of the outstanding missionary pioneers in the early decades of the 20th century for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, was one of the pioneers in opening that work there, although it was necessary for him to learn a second language, which he did post haste. He had worked in the Umbur area in the northeast first, then had helped pioneer the work in Nagercoil in the extreme south, and then went as the advance guard to open work in Trivandrum. In the period of the First World War, the mission encountered painful difficulties because most of the missionaries working for the Missouri Synod in India were German citizens, and India was British territory. Some of them, like Pastor Now, were actually detained in Germany during the war, and others had different degrees of difficulty. But after the war was over, the Missouri Synod began an aggressive new expansion program for its India mission, and from 1920 to 1930 sent 60 new missionaries. The membership gains also indicate an encouraging growth, for in 1919 there had been only 1,681 baptized members, but in 1930 there were 7,170. After the period of the First World War also, a new dimension of the mission enterprise in India was the work among the Muslims, which was spearheaded by Adolf Brooks in 1924. He was a 1921 graduate of the seminary in St. Louis, then earned a doctorate in Islamic studies before he went to the Indian mission field. He worked among the Muslims in Bani Yambadi, which was also in the Ambur area in the north. When Brooks was permitted to come home on furlough, a replacement was to take over this work, but the work was difficult and the enterprise was dropped eventually. Brooks himself encountered considerable difficulty on the question of prayer fellowship, and while on furlough was dismissed from service in the Missouri Synod. In hindsight, many leaders in the Missouri Synod would consider this a most tragic development, that we lost the services of that man and did him that great injustice. Another significant development in the post-World War I period was the opening of a seminary for the training of pastors in Niagara Coil, which opened its doors in 1924 with 7 students and 3 professors. This was the second Missouri Synod Seminary to be opened in any overseas mission field. It should also be mentioned that work from South India spread to Ceylon, now called Sri Lanka, when members from the town of Vadakkangalam moved to Colombo, the capital of Ceylon. By 1928, an Indian evangelist had been sent there to look after their spiritual needs. From this beginning, the work in Sri Lanka has grown, so it is now a separate mission enterprise of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Also significant is the year 1958, for on January 8th and 9th of that year, the India Evangelical Lutheran Church was organized. This marks the graduation of the mission into partner church status, a most significant development. Because of the vast area which our mission has covered, there had been a separate district synod which was organized in Trivandrum already in October 1956. Another district synod was organized in Niagara Coil in November 1956, and several years after that, the earliest mission stations in the north, west of Madras, were organized into the Ambur district. The 3 district synods together then comprised the India Evangelical Lutheran Church. Now, even with the organization of a sister church called the India Evangelical Lutheran Church, our work there, the work of witnessing, the work of the Lutheran ministry is by no means completely out of the forest or out of the woods. There are still 2 main problems which prevail. One is how Lutheran pastors and congregations try to cope with the problem of caste, which is still deeply entrenched in some places in India. And the other is the problem of disparate economic levels of the church here in America compared with the church in India. And it has been shown that an overamount of financial support not only does not help the church, but actually deteriorates the quality of the ministry and destroys the morale of the indigenous pastors in India. And these are some of the problems that still remain to be solved. Our Southeast Chinese extraction, coming from the city of Amoy some centuries back, they speak their own language, which is called Hokkien or Taiwanese. And the newcomers from the mainland, of course, speak Mandarin, and there is a bit of a split between the two, and most of the Mandarin pastors now working in the China Evangelical Lutheran Church, which is our former mission on Taiwan, would have all people listen to the preaching of the gospel only in Mandarin, the standard Chinese, and we have failed, really, to break through the linguistic and the cultural barrier to reach out to the predominant Taiwanese population. But there has been some progress, and in 1976, the China Evangelical Lutheran Church reported 2,397 baptized members and 1,240 communicant members. But in the final analysis, when one evaluates the work among the Chinese, we would have to admit that we do not have any great startling successes to write home about, that our work has been rather pedestrian for the most part and only very partially successful. My topic is further Missouri Synod expansion in overseas mission fields, and specifically in China and in other areas of the Far East among Chinese people. The India mission enterprise must have provided some spin-off in publicity to people and church leaders in the Missouri Synod. Before very long, there is evident an interest in further mission expansion in Asia, and this interest was especially directed to China. In the early part of the 20th century, hardly any alert person in the civilized world could avoid some kind of awareness of the immensity of the China problem. Whereas India and many other parts of Asia, as also Africa, were open to European colonial expansion ever since the 16th century, China had closed its borders to foreigners. It was only with great difficulty that a few foreign diplomatic officials gained entree into China, and only in a very controlled situation were any foreigners permitted to trade in China. On the southern coast of China is the seaport of Canton, where there was a government-controlled organization which monitored foreign trade and controlled it. Because foreign merchants, especially British and Americans, found opium import trade so lucrative, they were carrying huge shiploads of this narcotic into the port of Canton. This motivated the Chinese emperor to put a total ban on the import of opium. This, in turn, infuriated the foreigners to the point that a war resulted between Great Britain and China called the First Opium War, 1839 to 1842. In the Treaty of Nanking, a settlement was imposed on the defeated Chinese by the British government, which required the Chinese to open certain ports to foreign trade along the southeast coast of China. The Chinese called this the first of the unequal treaties, so-called because they imposed inequitable conditions on the Chinese by their victorious conquerors, first the British, and then also by the British and the French, and eventually other nations also taking part. In these unequal treaties, several especially obnoxious clauses were contained, one of them being the principle of extraterritoriality. Another condition of the treaties established open ports in China was the requirement that the Chinese protect Christians. This applied not only to the foreigners who were Christians, but also Chinese who became converts to Christianity. Although this looked like an innocuous condition that was imposed upon the Chinese, it provoked all kinds of problems in the decades toward the end of the 19th century. This was because when people had a grievance against a government official, they could claim that they were Christians and thus seek protection from foreign diplomatic officials. This kind of a condition imposed on the unwilling Chinese, therefore, jeopardized the purity of Christian mission gain in China. Another difficulty which grew out of the unequal treaties as far as missionaries are concerned was the fact that missionaries were considered a special threat because they were an alternative leadership class in China which threatened to compete with the Chinese gentry or the Mandarin class. The Chinese Mandarin class was the educated class in China from which all the government officials in China were drawn. Among a people which otherwise did not go to school because of the harshness of economic life, educated missionaries thus were associated with the Mandarin class, comprising a direct threat to the influence and prestige of the Chinese officials. It can be understood, therefore, that the presence of the missionaries, which aroused the jealousy and suspicion of the officials, could also have some negative spin-offs besides the positive effects which Christian mission work had hopefully had in China. Before the end of the 19th century, there were many sharp confrontations between Christian missionaries and Chinese officials, which sometimes resulted in violence. Because of the clause in the treaties which protected the Christians, foreign diplomats were permitted to police the places where uprisings broke out against Christians and foreign missionaries. It can be understood that the Chinese developed tremendous antagonisms to foreigners and to foreign missionaries. This is one of the main motivations which powered the momentum to a more thorough revolution in China in the many decades after the Opium Wars. It must also be said that Roman Catholic missionaries in China, especially the French, were among the most aggressive among the Western missionaries. France at that time was trying to rebuild the Second Empire and therefore took a very aggressive line in Asia in order to build overseas imperial holdings. When the French saw how easily the British had defeated the Chinese in the First Opium War, the French were more than anxious to take part alongside the British in what is called the Second Opium War, 1856 to 1860. In this war, the Chinese military forces were again easily defeated by the Western powers because of superior armament and technology and further unequal treaties imposed on them. The French Catholics especially took advantage of the defeat of the Chinese and extracted conditions favorable to French Catholic missionaries and other Catholics as well, in a way which the Chinese called downright fraudulent. The French Catholics also insisted that the Chinese government officially concede the French clergy the right to wear the attire of the different ranks of the Chinese mandarins. Only this very simple survey should make us aware of the fact that as the confrontations between Western powers and the Chinese unfolded in the decades of the 19th century, the relationships were often very strained and very bitter after effects remained between the two parties. This made Christian mission work in China very difficult. From the middle of the 19th century, there had been various Lutheran mission societies and churches engaged in the mission outreach in China. Toward the end of the 19th century, there were also some Lutheran groups from America who participated. In 1913, a mission society for missions in China was undertaken by a group of Lutheran pastors and congregations who had organized themselves as the Evangelical Lutheran Mission Society for China. The real dynamo behind this whole enterprise, not only of the founding of the society, but also as its first missionary to go to China, was Professor E. L. Arndt. Arndt was a Missouri Synod pastor and a graduate of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. He had become interested in many other areas besides theology. He studied natural science at a time when this was still a very young discipline for many people. He also became interested in world affairs as a young pastor. Because of his interest in natural science, he was called as a professor to Concordia College, St. Paul, Minnesota. There he had the opportunity to meet Lutheran missionaries of other synods who were on furlough, and thus engendered a burning zeal in his heart and his conscience to persuade the Missouri Synod also to undertake mission work in China. However, the synodical officials felt that the new mission enterprise in India would long demand all the available resources of Synod, and therefore Arndt repeatedly was rebuffed. So it was a matter of frustration and even desperation that moved him to organize this society. Arndt began on an old second-hand printing press to publish a periodical in German for engendering mission publicity for his China enterprise, and he traveled around Minnesota and surrounding states as much as he could to arouse the interest of pastors, societies and congregations, and whole congregations. And thus this Society for Missions in China came into being under Arndt's guidance. Membership in the society was open to any individual or group which subscribed to the Lutheran confessions, and actually there were members not only in the Missouri Synod, but also in other synods, especially those affiliated with the Synodical Conference. After the group had been organized and after some funds had been collected for the sending of a missionary, it was found impossible to enlist the services of any pastor to spearhead this mission in China. And thus Arndt himself volunteered to go as the first missionary of this society. In February 1913, Arndt, his wife, and several of his children arrived in Shanghai. And the difficulty of travel in the interior of China at that time was extreme. The Chinese Revolution had broken out in October 1911, and central China was in a state of chaos. The feeble government in Peking in the north was unable to preserve anything more than a semblance of law and order. In fact, this was the beginning of the period of the warlords, as so aptly described by Pearl Buck in some of her writings. Especially foreigners who traveled in China, therefore, did so considerably at their own risk. But Arndt ventured to go up to the city of Hankou, some 600 miles up the Yangtze River above Shanghai, where he located in rented quarters. Arndt had a fierce determination to master the Chinese language, although he was almost 50 years old by the time he arrived in China. He knew some Chinese through self-study and through ad hoc tutors whom he met along the way, before he even reached Hankow. But once he was in Hankow, he began language study with a determination that has seldom been rivaled. Within 6 months, he was able to preach the gospel in Chinese. He had not even waited till that point of achievement before he began mission work, when he engaged partly trained teachers from other Lutheran missions to assist him in opening schools in the city, as well as in other cities of the tri-cities of central China. Opening schools was one of the most effective mission methods for that situation at that time, because there were not nearly enough elementary schools for all the Chinese children to attend, and one could freely introduce any amount of religious instruction in elementary schools in China at that time, besides charging a modest amount of tuition also. The schools which aren't funded, therefore, soon became self-supporting from the tuition money which paid even the salaries of the Chinese teachers whom aren't hired and trained for this purpose. He himself had busy days going around to all the schools to monitor and supervise the teachers in their functions, and also to teach religion in each of the schools in turn, till he had competent Chinese teachers who could take over that function. Besides that, Arndt conducted evangelistic services in the schools and other locations which he had rented on busy streets, being busy with this evangelism outreach every night of the week. He often had his teachers take part in such evangelistic services and make brief presentations. One of the difficulties which the Mission Society for China, which was supporting Arndt in his work there, was experiencing was the fact that they were unable to solicit enough pastors to serve as missionaries in the many openings which were evident in the China field. One man had been secured, namely Erhard Riedel, but beyond that it seemed that no further workers would be forthcoming. Therefore, the officers of the Mission Society appealed to the Synodical Conference to have that organization take over the mission enterprise in China. The Missouri Synod, however, intervened and expressed the official judgment that the Missouri Synod should be the one to take over this project rather than the Synodical Conference. Thus, in 1917, the mission was officially taken over by Synod. One of the most immediate benefits of this action was that the synodical organizational structure was able to draft seminary graduates to serve in the China mission field. There soon were additional workers, therefore, who were sent out to help Arndt and Riedel expand the many openings which they saw, and from the beginnings in Hankow, the mission enterprise soon spread to other towns, especially upward along the Yangtze, and also into other towns in Hubei province, in which Hankow was also located. In spite of the fact that the Chinese Revolution was continuing in the 1920s, the Missouri Synod enterprise in those years made some considerable progress, but there were some considerable difficulties also. One of the difficulties pertained to the relationship that the Missouri Synod Lutherans should have with other Lutheran churches and other Lutheran mission societies. We have to keep in mind that this was the period of the aftermath of the election controversy, which had seriously torn apart the unanimity in the Synodical Conference. The issue had been the doctrine of election or predestination, a serious theological matter on which some Lutheran groups in America did not preserve an immaculate biblical stance. It can be understood, therefore, that the leadership of the Missouri Synod was very much concerned about this issue as it applied to the foreign mission field. Because of this high level of concern, the new director of missions for the Missouri Synod, Dr. Frederick Brunt, felt a mandate and compulsion to steer the mission enterprise in China into a course which would insulate it from any effective contact with other Lutherans. In the middle of the 1920s, Director Brunt personally went to China to supervise the conferences of the missionaries there and insisted on a policy which gave the Missouri Synod's mission even a different name in Chinese from that which the other Lutherans had picked. The other Lutherans, regardless of whether they were from Europe or from North America, called themselves Sinihui, which reflected the Lutheran doctrine of salvation and justification only by faith. And under Director Brunt's tutelage, the Missouri Synod missionaries decided to take the name Lu Dehui, which is the transliteration of Martin Luther's name, into Chinese. An additional problem, which was more internal, was the term question in Chinese. This dealt with the question, what term in Chinese should be used for God? In the ranks of the Missouri Synod clergy, there were sharp differences of opinion. These differences came to the fore in a number of conferences and were so intense that they actually jeopardized a harmonious cooperation in the overall mission enterprise of Missouri Synod missionaries at that time. Besides the internal difficulties that the mission experienced in the middle 1920s, there soon was added a crescendo of effects on all the missions working in especially central China. This is called the Northern Expedition, which upset all of central China in the middle of the 1920s. This was the time when the Nationalist Party, called also, according to the Chinese, the Kuomintang or KMT, under Dr. Sun Yat-sen, and the Chinese Communist Party were working out a united front for the purpose of unifying all of China and purging China of all the warlords. Sun Yat-sen died before this was effected, but under his successors in 1926, this united front undertook a military drive from Canton in the south to central China, aiming at Hankou, the precise city where the Missouri Synod headquarters were located. Since the communist element was dominant in setting the policies of the United Front and the Northern Expedition, this was a period of special violence in the Chinese Revolution. When the army reached Hankou, most of the foreign missions felt very threatened because, of course, the policy of the United Front was very strongly anti-imperialist and therefore anti-foreign, and therefore also anti-Christian. And the missionaries all felt threatened, and almost all the foreign personnel evacuated to Shanghai on the coast or even left China completely. It needs to be emphasized that the veteran Missouri Synod missionary, Dr. E. L. Arndt, was the only one of our mission who remained at his post in central China during those trying years. When the smoke finally cleared from this more violent outburst of the Chinese Revolution, it was discovered that the mission had sustained enormous losses. Even though the missionaries returned to their post, it was not an easy task to rebuild the stations or to gather again the inquirers and the church members with whom they had been working, whom they had been instructing and teaching in Christian doctrine. The attempt to unify China under the United Front had failed, and therefore warlords of different types held local control in many different parts of China again, which had a continuing detrimental effect on mission work. This was largely because warlords often fought each other and devastated the countryside as the surge of battle swayed to and fro. In some places, there were cities that changed hands many times a year, with each warlord taxing the population to the extreme. Those years towards the end of the 1920s were extremely difficult years for Christian missionaries and also for Christians in central China. In spite of all the difficulties, however, the mission enterprise really flourished in the early 1930s. One factor was that Chiang Kai-shek, who had inherited the leadership of the National Party, or the KMT, from Sun Yat-sen, and who was also the military commander of KMT forces, made a serious attempt at unifying China once more. He also tried to suppress the communists. One of the special factors indicative of growth and progress in the Lutheran mission enterprise in those years is the seminary which our missionaries had established in the city of Hankou in February 1922. This is of some importance, for this is the first overseas seminary founded by the Missouri Synod. The school was opened February 15, 1922, with 21 students in all, 13 of them studying to become evangelists, two of them teachers from the schools of the Missouri Synod. Six of the students were members from various Missouri Synod congregations. There were a few casualties during this first school year. There were in all 17 students left in attendance after the first year was completed. With the help of Chinese pastors and evangelists trained in our own seminary, the capable missionaries working for the church in our China mission achieved some remarkable success in the middle 1930s in spite of great difficulties in China. One of the Chinese pastors, who was himself a graduate of our Hankou Seminary, by himself, without any help from any missionary, launched a veritable revival movement in northern China, from which he had come originally, and this has been very little documented and is very little known in our circles because all the sources and reports about it are in Chinese. However, there were some new difficulties which the missions encountered in the 1930s, and this also had a very detrimental effect on the work of this aggressive Pastor B working in North China. In 1931, Japan had invaded Manchuria in a full and ruthless campaign to secure land and resources on the Asian mainland before Chiang Kai-shek would be able to recruit all of China under one government. One must understand the predicament of the Japanese, for they have hardly any natural resources on the few rocky islands on which they live, and they well realize that the only way that Japan can remain a viable modern nation is by getting control of resources that were close at hand on the mainland. The invasion and conquest of Manchuria in 1931 did not directly harm our missions so much, but it did weaken the Chinese government. In the middle 1930s, another crucial development in world affairs took place, which involved a real threat against the totalitarian powers, especially Germany and Japan. And this movement came from the Russian Comintern, the international arm of the Communist Party. Russia had become very much concerned about the threat from Hitler's Germany and from a very aggressive Japan, so they had sent out the word that all communist parties all over the world should cooperate also even with the democracies to fight first of all the fascist powers under which they understood Mussolini's Italy, Hitler's Germany, and also Imperial Japan. This action by the Comintern in a secret meeting at the very end of 1935 provoked the Japanese into further conquest in China as soon as they could mobilize for this. And this materialized in the true pronged invasion of China from the north and also from the east, thus down from Manchuria and the Japanese bases up there, and up the Yangtze Valley from Shanghai. Before long, this central China military enterprise of the Japanese reached Hankow and other places where our mission stations were located. And this had a most detrimental and depressing effect on all church work, including the work of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. There were millions of Chinese who fled before the invading Japanese army, and there were millions of Chinese who were killed in the battles and died of disease and starvation because of the upheavals of the war. In the Tri-Cities around Hankow, our church had by that time 11 congregations, most of which had parochial schools. Almost the whole membership in all these churches was scattered about so that most of these congregations ceased to function as churches. 800 or so miles inland from Shanghai, in central China, there were sections which the Japanese had not occupied and where mission work could continue. That was the so-called unoccupied China. But with all the displaced persons and the military activities which were necessary to repel the Japanese invaders, even unoccupied China was not exactly an ideal area of the world in which to conduct aggressive mission work. A few years later, in 1941, came Pearl Harbor and the all-out Japanese attack on America and Great Britain also. During the period of the Second World War, some minimal measure of mission work continued in unoccupied China, but many of our missionaries suffered indescribable hardships, since some of them were interned by the Japanese, some driven out by the tides of war, and others found the uncertain conditions in central China really quite intolerable. Once peace was restored in 1945, the Missouri Synod made a concerted effort to rebuild the China mission. As soon as possible, a large contingent of new missionaries was sent out, but in the chaos which prevailed in the aftermath of the war, it was most difficult to immediately rebuild the congregations and mission stations because the economy and the society of China lay in absolute chaos. Another unfortunate development at that time was the resumption of the civil war between the KMT, or the Nationalists, and the Communists of China, which in a few years resulted in the Communist victory over Chiang Kai-shek. On October 1, 1949, Mao Zedong stood in Tian'an Square in Peking to proclaim the People's Republic of China. The new government had very little sympathy for Christian missions, and the Korean War, which broke out the year after that, did not help matters at all. Therefore, the few missionaries who had tried to stay behind under the communist regime were forced to leave, and 1952 marks the final close of our mission enterprise in China. Now, when we try to assess what the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod had achieved on mainland China, it must be kept in mind that the Lutheran Church worked there under great, almost impossible, difficulties and obstacles during the decades of the Chinese Revolution. But in spite of this, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Mission Enterprise founded a very promising seminary and prep school institution in which at one time some 50 students were enrolled, and they had congregations organized which had the promise of becoming really viable self-governing, self-propagating branches of the church. Work in the Missouri Synod was spread out over almost 2,000 miles in central China. But unfortunately, the total upheavals of the war, then finally the communist victory in China, capped off by the even more unfavorable stance of the communist regime in China towards Western missionaries, especially provoked by the Korean War, finished off what little promise there might have been. So in the final evaluation, one would have to say that the mission enterprise, not only of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but of all other missionaries and churches also, was, for the most part, a really tragic failure in mainland China. Now, some of the missionaries who had been evacuating China after the coming of the communists went south to the British Crown Colony of Hong Kong on the southern coast of China. Some were reassigned from there, but a few decided that Hong Kong itself provided a further challenge for mission work among Chinese. And thus, in February 1950, the Board for Missions of the Missouri Synod authorized the official beginning of a new China-related mission enterprise in Hong Kong, where we now have a Lutheran church which is affiliated with the Missouri Synod in the relationship of a partner church. The situation of Hong Kong and the condition which prevailed in this small British Crown colony have to be understood to appreciate the conditions under which the Hong Kong Lutheran Church has been functioning. In an area of slightly less than 400 square miles, there were literally hundreds of thousands of Chinese refugees fleeing the communists in China, streaming across the border in the years just before and after the communist conquest of China, coming destitute of all possessions, poor and sick and hungry. And it was especially among these mainland refugees that our missionaries resumed work in 1950. And before very long, work in Hong Kong, especially along the border with communist China, also branched out to the old Portuguese colony of Macau, some 40 miles to the northwest of Hong Kong, so that our mission work in Hong Kong really covered two distinct areas and two distinct European colonies. Among the first of our missionaries to work in Hong Kong was Reverend Wilbert Holt, who had worked in central China before, and then also Miss Gertrude Simon, Miss Martha Boss, and also Miss Lorraine Bailing. These had come from central China, evacuating because of the advance of the communists and the disturbed conditions in the interior, and very soon they began to see that there were new challenges which ought to be met in Hong Kong, and therefore they stayed on and petitioned the Board for Missions to recognize this as a new mission field of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And these people began Bible classes any place they could assemble a few people, out in the open, on the hillsides, in little mud huts, and what have you. And on March 26, 1950, the first formal service was conducted by our Lutheran mission in Hong Kong. There was one area outside of the populated urban area of Hong Kong, but within the limits of the British colony, where the colonial government had set up a refugee camp for the many tens of thousands of Chinese refugees. This was known as Rennie's Mill Camp. And there, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod operated one of its largest and also most rewarding mission enterprises in Hong Kong. As soon as the camp was open, 20,000 refugees settled there in makeshift shelters. Our missionaries immediately began Bible school and Sunday school and services also. Before very long, our missionary efforts expanded from Rennie's Mill refugee camp to other parts of the British Crown colony. And by 1950, as just mentioned, also by 1952, also to the Portuguese colony of Macau. And before long, some of the refugees established themselves in businesses and more permanent occupations in Hong Kong. Also, the mission in Hong Kong, in a gracious and easy way, which did not reveal much tension, was also able to reach out successfully to the South Chinese in Hong Kong who speak a different language, although related to Chinese, which is called Cantonese. And this is one of the features that marks not only our mission, but also that of other churches in Hong Kong, that they have been able to make a fairly gracious transition from using the Mandarin, or national language of China, and making a gracious outreach also to the Cantonese-speaking people who are natives of South China, Canton, and Hong Kong. One of the special opportunities which the situation in Hong Kong presented was working through elementary and high schools. The British government in Hong Kong does not have the aversion against joining of church and state like we here in America do, and they are happy to support Christian organizations which are willing to establish and maintain schools. Therefore, it has been relatively easy to establish schools in spite of the extremely crowded conditions in Hong Kong, some of the most densely populated areas in the whole world are to be found in the Hong Kong housing areas. The government would make land available and also support about 80% of the building costs for such schools for the countless Chinese children. And this means that the government was supporting different churches, also the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, in their school program. Because of the lack of strict separation of church and state in Hong Kong, it is possible for a congregation to undertake the building of large schools, hire teachers to man the staff of the school, and then also use the school facilities for services, as well as teach religion in the regular required curriculum of the school. This is one feature of the overall situation in Hong Kong, which makes that a mission field with a completely different shape than we have experienced hitherto in other parts of the world. Therefore, some of our churches have schools with several thousand pupils, while the congregation may have a membership of only 200 or so people. Now, this in itself poses some enormous problems, which have posed difficulties for our mission in Hong Kong, which they have not really been able to grapple with very graciously, because there are enormous amounts of money involved in the tuition payments which these children will make, the job openings that should be dispensed by the small group of Christians in the congregation which manages the school, positions on the board of managers for schools like that is a very coveted position, and so there have been all manner of intense problems connected with the particular situation prevalent there. But there are also some rewards. The population in Hong Kong is very fluid, and people move around back and forth within the colony, and they also leave the colony in great numbers, coming to America, to Canada, to Southeast Asia, to Taiwan, and other countries. And soul accounting, therefore, seems to be a problem of the first magnitude. But at the end of 1976, the church in Hong Kong did report a membership of 4,389 baptized members and 2,156 communicant members. Most recently now, the mission in Hong Kong has also been granted partner church status. This is the last of our mission fields overseas which has been granted this prerogative. Another area, not as close to China, but also in the general area of Southeast Asia, is the island of Taiwan, which is rather small compared to the size of any one of our average Midwestern states. It must be only about one-fourth or one-fifth the area of the state of Missouri. And this island used to belong to the Chinese, but was taken over by the Japanese in the war with China in 1895, and so for half a century, the island of Taiwan was a Japanese imperial possession. And then after the war, it was again returned to China, and it served as a refuge for Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist government when they experienced this sad defeat at the hands of the communists. Now, some of our Christians from Hong Kong went to Taiwan after 1950-51, and so our church officially opened a new mission in Taiwan in spring of 1952. One of the significant facts is that the China Seminary, located formerly in the city of Hankow, was continued in Taiwan. That is, therefore, still today, our church's oldest overseas seminary. In Taiwan, one of the peculiar difficulties which the church experiences is that most of the population of some 17 million people are of a Southeast Asian or Southeast Chinese extraction coming from the city of Amoy some centuries back. They speak their own language, which is called Hokkien or Taiwanese. And the newcomers from the mainland, of course, speak Mandarin, and there is a bit of a split between the two. And most of the Mandarin pastors now working in the China Evangelical Lutheran Church, which is our former mission on Taiwan, would have all people listen to the preaching of the gospel only in Mandarin, the standard Chinese. And we have failed, really, to break through the linguistic and the cultural barrier to reach out to the predominant Taiwanese population. But there has been some progress, and in 1976, the China Evangelical Lutheran Church reported 2,397 baptized members and 1,240 communicant members. But in the final analysis, when one evaluates the work among the Chinese, we would have to admit that we do not have any great startling successes to write home about, that our work has been rather pedestrian for the most part and only very partially successful.